Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a master of Hawaiian slack guitar.
And a look at the evolution, or perhaps de-evolution, of political comedy over the last two decades.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Affordability isn't a joke or some hoax. It is a real and consequential challenge that families across Arizona must grapple with every day.
We've seen a governor that wants to grow government spending, as you heard today. There are programs that she wants to invest in a time where Arizonans are, they're having a hard time with their funds, they're having a hard time with their economy.
80% of what the governor asked for is in this bill. We agree on not increasing SALT. No tax on tips. The governor wants it. I want it. No tax on overtime. The governor wants it. I want it.
If you put that bill on the floor, it should get, I would say, supermajority support. There's no reason to delay it other than Republicans wanting to hold middle-class families hostage in order to provide tax breaks for billionaires and corporations.
He definitely was a conservative, a lifelong conservative, and that guided his principles. But at the end of the day, it was about doing right by the people of Arizona. And he, you know, loved this state and loved the people he served.
And with me to talk about the start of the legislative session and its first policy dispute, as well as much more, are Marcus Dellartino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And former State House Minority Leader Reginald Boulding. Reginald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let me start with you, Reginald, Governor's State of the State speech. What stood out to you from what she had to say this week?
Well, I think the governor hit on, you know, what everyday Arizonans are talking about, which is affordability. You know, I don't think it was a secret that she was going to talk about, you know, housing and, you know health care and child care and really, you know, positioning that with the fact that Arizona has revenue issues right now. And I think that it was really important for her to, you know, talk about her own personal story, her own personal struggles of, you know, how everyday Arizonans have to make these decisions. And, you know, for her, her agenda this year, hopefully working with the legislature, is going to be to make sure that everyday Arizonans have the ability to live and thrive here in the state.
Marcus, what were your impressions?
I think we all knew affordability was going to be top of the ticket. I thought it was interesting. You know, keep in mind, this is a Democratic governor in a state that's a Republican majority. She's in an election year, so she's got to bridge some gap and be bipartisan, right? But she took they'd probably disagree with me on this, but a populist message on picking on a couple things that's popular across the aisle to pick on. One's data centers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we already know Neil Carter, very conservative Republican from Pinal County, is running a bill to get rid of the tax credit for data centers. The governor's on board and promoted that. And so now she didn't call out Neil specifically, but, you know, they're on the same page. That's very popular in Arizona right now. She challenged the data centers on water consumption, very popular in Arizona right now. And then the other one, I'm a fan, but picking on Airbnb. So, you know, that's a populist message in Arizona right now. I mean, we've really reached this threshold of how far are we going to go on this Airbnb thing. So I thought that was interesting that she sort of, you know, the political spectrum is not a flat line, it's a circle, and we're starting to see her meet up with the Republicans on a few issues.
Well, and she also didn't really talk as much about, for example, ESAs, the school vouchers, as she had in the past. Remember her first year, she called to basically totally undo the universal voucher expansion, which I'm sure she knew at the time was not going anywhere at the state capitol. Each year, she's tried to do some things to sort of rein it in a bit. This year, it seemed like less of a big deal in the speech.
I think she's really focused on tax conformity right now, at least. I think she does recognize the fact the chances of that getting reformed in this legislature are somewhere in between zero and not impossible. and so she hit it, and largely for a PR, but not for legal reasons, and is probably going to rely on her Democratic colleagues in the legislature to keep pounding that message and launch bills.
Marcus, Reginald, which issues stood out to you? I mean, Marcus talked about the Airbnb and the data centers, and she obviously talked about affordability, as you mentioned as well. Like, were there specific things that maybe surprised you that she talked a little bit about, or that you're glad that she specifically hit on?
I mean, no. I mean, I think, you know, what Marcus talked through is absolutely what people every day are talking about. You know, there's significant issues. You know, you have Prop 123, which is a big issue that legislators have to make sure.
Education
funding initiative that they have to make sure that they get, you know, passed. There has to be some consensus there, which I think is extremely important. I mean, you know, you can't open up a newspaper without seeing, you know, a school that's, you know, shutting down, or, you know, teachers that are being laid off. That's a real thing. So, you know, making sure that they're able to, you know, fill those deficits is going to be important. But again, you know, those key issues, you know, in talking about, you know, water, you know, talking about, you know, housing, though, these are conversations that, you know, Republicans and Democrats are having. You know, even in D.C., you have, you know, Donald Trump talking about, you know, limiting corporations from buying, you know, homes. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a bill that, you know, Democrats in the state legislature have been running over the last 5 years. So you're starting to see some convergence on these issues that, you know, are centered around affordability.
All right. Here's the cynical question for you guys. How much of the speech was laying out policy for this year, and how much of the speech was campaign speech?
You know, I think I don't know if there's a difference. I don't know if you can separate the two. Right. I don't really think you can. I mean, at the end of the day, the governor's job is going to be to show Arizonans that they can, that she can deliver for them. And, you know, I think if you look over the last several years, she's had a pretty good case. And the legislature, they've worked collectively together. You know, there's been a number of vetoes, but when they've been able to come together on a budget, they've been able to get good things done. Now, at a federal level, that's been a total, a mess. But, you know, they've been ultimately able to get some things done together.
Marcus, what do you think? Campaign speech, policy speech?
I agree with Reggie on this one. I don't think I've seen a state of the state, both from the federal level or state level, that hasn't had some tone of politics in it. But politics is policy, too, right? You're highlighting your strengths and you're limiting your weaknesses. So to that end, you know, it's a political speech. Yeah, it's about policy, but both of them are intertwined.
Okay. So, Marcus, you mentioned tax conformity, which in most years is one of those subjects that you say it and people's eyes kind of glaze over. But this year, we might be looking at our first veto, possibly even today. The governor called for sort of a more limited set of conforming the state's tax code to what the federal government did in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The legislature has approved a bill that had more of what Congress and President Trump put into it. She hasn't said specifically, I'm going to veto this, but she's kind of made it clear that she's not a fan.
I think what probably would give you the clearest indication was the vote coming out of the legislature yesterday, which was a fully partisan vote, all Democrats against it, all Republicans for it. So to that end, if I was going to guess, I'm going to guess that we're looking at a veto. I would agree with you. Like, I got to tell you, I mean, there has never been an issue with tax conformity in 30 years of watching this stuff. It is the most boring bill that could ever pass. Mm-hmm. And usually it's unanimous and just gets moved along. You know, the governor obviously wants the deduction for tips, overtime, et cetera, but the bill in the totality comes to about $240, $250 million. What the Republicans have done is limited. They took out the SALT deduction, and I'm not going to geek out and talk about what that is. They took out accelerated depreciation. I'm not going to geek out and talk about what that is. But, you know, that could be generally portrayed as helping the more wealthy. And so the Republicans in the legislature have taken that out and then retargeted those cuts to the more middle and less fortunate in the tax code. So but to that problem, it creates a bigger hole. So now we're up to $450 in the Republican budget. So really
$450 million.
So really, at the end of the day, the fight is not about necessarily – there are a couple issues, and one revolves around education, but there's a couple issues. But largely, this argument is coming down to how much it is going to be, less than it is about the policy.
Reginald, do you agree with that? That it's less about who is benefiting maybe from these tax breaks, and more about trying to decide how big a hole this is going to put in the state budget?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things, right? I do think when you look at, you know, if you conform to, you know, federal changes, and you look at the bill, you're talking about nearly a little bit over $1 billion over 3 years that would be lost. So, you know, you can cut revenue today, but that shows up as fewer classrooms, larger fees, deeper deficits for, you know, tomorrow. So I do think that is that's a real thing, right? You know, one of the things that is going to be extremely important right now is to make sure that either plan, they can actually talk about how they're going to pay for it. And I think the governor, you know, as she released, you know, her budget today, you know, she'll, you know, kind of talk through that. But, you know, you can't cut, you know, $450 million today and say, we'll figure out how we're going to pay for it tomorrow. It just doesn't work that way.
It's tough to cut 200-something million dollars out of the budget today and say we'll figure out down the road how to pay for it too, though, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and I think, like, you know, going into the question is, you know, there has to be some hard decisions that are going to need to be made. And, you know, it's going to ultimately line up with, you know, where are your, you know, your values and priorities. And, you know, I think the governor, she's, you know, looked at some places where you can get revenue, you know, as she, you know, looked at Target, you know, Airbnb and, you know, looking at data centers and, you know, ending some of these subsidies. And so she's trying to find opportunities for revenue. But more or less, I would say the big thing regarding this tax conformity is I'm going to use the word leverage. You know, this is something that's at the top of the list for the Republican legislature. And I think the governor also has some really big things that she won as well. And I think this provides her an opportunity to leverage some of her goals with, you know, the goal of the Republican legislature.
I just want to make sure every Arizonan understands this, because she hit a little bit on this point, but most people don't know that this exists. And I'm specifically talking to any Republican congressman from Arizona. The federal government owes us over $700 million. And that is due to immigration enforcement in Arizona, where we spent Arizona state taxpayer money on a federal responsibility. They've agreed that they owe states that have done that money. There's over $700 million that the feds have not cut back to Arizona. We need to get that money. It's not my responsibility as an Arizona taxpayer to fund a federal responsibility. It equates to a double taxation, and I am not a fan of taxes in the first place, much less double taxing me. So let's go get that money back, and that would ease a lot of the issues that we're talking about at the state of Arizona.
Marcus, when you talk about trying to fill in the gap, we heard from House Appropriations Committee Chair David Livingston this week, who essentially said, look, maybe one way to do this is to pass a fairly clean version of the Prop 123 extension. The state, of course, had to backfill that, had to pay general fund money in the current fiscal year's budget, 300 some odd million dollars. That would cover the governor's proposal, not entirely the Republicans' proposal. But I wonder, like, wasn't that money that in theory was going to be going to schools anyway, assuming that they sent something to the voters and voters approved it? Like, is that really filling a hole?
Well, it's filling a hole from the general fund. And I guess that's probably where the technical part of this exists. So the question is, if you pass 123 with the voters, then that money's coming out of state land. So the proceeds are on sale of state lands or leases from state lands, versus not doing it means that $300 million is coming out of the general fund. So passing it gives you $300 more million dollars in the general fund to play with. And frankly, it just makes fiscal sense.
But they only had to pay it last year because they didn't send something to the voters in the first place, right?
Correct. That is correct. And there doesn't – I thought it was odd. I would be a little bit more exercised, I think, if I were a legislator about getting $300 million. But I guess in this grand scheme of thing, $300 million is not as much as I – seem to think
it
is.
19 some odd million dollar budget. Right. Interesting.
But yeah, I expect it. And also it's a lesson in the totality of fiscal discussions, right? Yes, right now we're focused on tax conformity, but it is part of a state budget, and Prop 123 is part of a state budget. So we're going to have an exercise and a little give and take.
Just one more quick question before we move on to each of you. Reginald, you talked about leverage before the break with the governor. Like, there's a very obvious deadline here, right? People have to file their taxes in April. There are forms that are already, you know, some people like to get a head start and start filing their taxes even now. How do you see this playing out? Because it looks like there's a pretty deep chasm, both money-wise and policy-wise, between the legislature and governor. They got to get this figured out.
No, they absolutely have to get it figured out. And, you know, the best way to do that is for the governor to set some type of deadline, right? The legislature works against deadlines. And, you know, if you're able to say that, hey, you know, in order for us to, you know, reissue forms or in order for us to, you know, make sure that we're actually not going to delay taxpayers, we have to do it by X date. I think that kind of gets the ball rolling a little bit, you know, more. But, you know, the legislature moved pretty quick. I think the governor, she's going to be very aggressive this, you know, this upcoming week. And, you know, my hope is that they're absolutely able to come to an agreement. The worst possible thing would be for taxpayers to have to file taxes twice because we weren't able to figure this thing out.
Yeah, that seems like it would be a really unpopular thing to have happen.
Oh, it's super unpopular. I mean, no, listen, everybody had to pay quarterly taxes if you have that tax situation yesterday, and it's an unpleasant experience, let me tell you. So doing it twice will not be fun. I think, you know, maybe we get a veto message today. The next day, or about 5 minutes after that happens, I think the Republicans will probably hold a press conference beating the tar out of the governor. And 5 minutes after that, they'll be in the governor's office saying, okay, how are we going to fix this? Because tax time's coming up. We got to get there.
Do you think there's room for negotiation, that they will actually sit in a room and talk about this?
I actually agree with Livingston. I mean, I think he undersold it. I think they're 85% there, if not 90% of there. I don't think there's that much of a distance, especially when you take into account Prop 1, 2, 3. I think if they all got together and put a little pressure on the feds to fork over $700 million that they owe us, I think that helps out significantly. I think there are opportunities to get there.
All right. We'll have to see how that plays out. Guys, let's talk a little bit about former Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich. He passed away suddenly this week at the age of 59. Marcus, he was somebody who, like, he was part of some pretty high-profile cases. We talked earlier this week about his lawsuit about in-state tuition at these state universities. He was part of the abortion issue, reviving the territorial era ban. He had some part to play in the 2020 election, basically one of the first elected Republicans in the state to say everything was fine here. We don't have to worry about it. When you look back on his legacy in that office, what comes to mind for you?
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I mean, I had more than my fair time with Mark, and he would regularly give us a call for political advice, and I will miss him. He made me my takeaway is I laughed a lot with that guy. He was hilariously funny and had the most amazing memory. He was quoting statistics. I was like, how do you keep – now, I don't know about Reggie, but after I had kids, I don't remember anything. it's like a memory wipe every single day. He just had the ability to remember everything. I think, you know, and we're certainly seeing it in some of the social media things. Obviously, he was loved by the conservatives, and I think they were watching that a lot of that happen on social media. But, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up sort of the Trump recount in Arizona. And that was – for a guy who was sort of what I would say the beginning of this Trump populist moment by going after ASU on tuition, which was, you know, sort of – MAGA thing, before MAGA was MAGA, now he's sort of got scarred with the audit. And so that was unfortunate for him because he was considered a bright and rising star within the Republican and the conservative movement.
Reginald, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you think about, you know, definitely his first term in office, I think, you know, he definitely was someone who, you know, wasn't afraid to go after Republicans or Democrats. I mean, that's something that he really was strong there. I know Mark and I, we actually worked on a few things together.
When you were in the legislature.
When I was in the legislature. Yeah. Huh. You know, we had a pretty big bill that, you know, something that many, you know, Republicans were afraid to do at the time was to say that, you know, in officer-involved shootings that there should be outside agencies to actually investigate it. Mark and I, we did a, you know, joint press release on it, and he supported the bill, testified on it and everything. So, I mean, he was someone who really he took strong stance and he believed in what he did. So, you know, I definitely remember him from that.
It's interesting, Marcus, when you talk about laughing a lot with him, because that's one of the things that I've kept reading about how, and I mentioned this when we spoke with his former chief of staff, Joe Canfield. I was listening back to an interview that we had done with him a few years ago, and he talked about how he didn't go off a set list when he did an interview. Like, he would just kind of say stuff, and, you know, as a Grateful Dead fan, you know, he, you know, worked those kinds of references into conversations. Of course, there's the famous nunchuck video that nobody who saw it will ever forget. I mean, he definitely was somebody who seemed like a real human being as opposed to just a politician.
That was a great way to put it. That's what I would have said, is that, you know, we like to say the man of the people. But he was just Mark, you know, and he loved making fun of himself in addition to everybody else. And I think that was part of his charm, and I think it's a quality that's somewhat missing in elected officials today. I mean, some of them certainly are men of the people, but others consider them, you know, too cool for school. So that was part of his charm and his allure, I think.
Definitely. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you look at, you know, his time in office, and, you know, you had the Senate run and, you know, later in his career, as you mentioned, the audit, you know, those were some of the things that I think, you know, some people may remember about him. But, you know, ultimately, you know, he definitely, you know, was really strong and really provided, you know, was always approachable and provided really a great deal of service to the state.
The last thing that I will add is he built a bench of staff, you know, younger folks that worked for him, loved him. And really built sort of a family following in his office. And that, for me, says a lot about the character of Mark.
That's interesting. Reginald, let me ask you about the DNC this week. Basically is saying we need to register more voters in Arizona, which if you've been looking at voter registration numbers in the state for any amount of time, that seems like kind of an obvious statement. But they're trying to focus on younger voters. Sounds like they're trying to go after maybe some of the same voters that were voting for Donald Trump during the last campaign. They're starting this effort. They say it's a 7-figure investment starting in Arizona and Nevada. Like, to be cynical, is it too cynical to say this is maybe too little too late for the Democrats in Arizona?
No, I don't think so. I mean, when you talk about, you know, registering voters, you know, most people start to really, you know, jump into voter registration during the year of actual election. So I don't think they're starting too late. I do think that what the DNC is saying is that not only is Arizona in play, but Arizona is absolutely essential to any type of, you know, national, you know, victories. And, you know, the fact is, if you look at, you know, 18 to 34 year olds, you know, they're not showing strong allegiance to any party, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. They're basically, you know, up for grabs. And, you know, having the ability to actually have younger voters talk to other younger voters about issues, I think is extremely important. And I think that ultimately, you know, what you'll see is that, you know, it's going to definitely have some type of investment.
Marcus, is there an opportunity maybe for Democrats here for some of these voters? Reginald referenced they don't necessarily have an allegiance. They seem to like Donald Trump, but maybe don't necessarily care so much about other politicians. Like, if it's not Trump on the ballot, maybe they're more up for grabs.
You know, this whole thing's interesting to me because they're going into Arizona and Nevada. Nevada had a Democrat voter registration edge. Donald Trump won. Republicans had a voter registration here in Arizona. They're increasing that registration. So, you know, I've been saying for a long time, Democrats got to stop the bleed. And I really – that for them, I think it should have started 2 years ago. But, you know, right now you can see them coming and starting to get their footing, right? Now we've got money. We're going to go do voter registration. We're going to target those younger voters, which is exactly what conservatives did. It was actually Charlie Kirk built a business around it, for God's sakes. And so they're going to go do that. In addition, you're watching Senator Warren up on the Hill, you know, basically doing a press conference saying, I've got the message that wins for Democrats. And so you can clearly see the organizing's going on. I think they still – voter registration, I think, goes hand in hand with messaging, and I think Democrats are still struggling to find that message that would move that younger voter.
Interesting. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Marcus Tellertino, Reginald Boulding, thanks you both for coming in. Really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a Grammy Award-winning guitar player who holds generations of musical knowledge.
But first, late last year, we noticed an intriguing event listing at ASU, a comedy show hosted by Turning Point USA. It featured stand-up from right-wing comic Alex Stein and a conservative writer, R.C. Maxwell, who chatted with the crowd about the virtues of being a, quote, happy warrior and offered advice on how to make fun of Democrats. The event caught our eye because it felt like part of a larger trend we've been tracking here at the show, the rightward drift of comedy. It wasn't so long ago that comedy was practically synonymous with the left. But things have changed, and we've been trying to figure out why. So, not long ago, I spoke to Nick Marks, a professor of film and media studies at Colorado State University, and the author of a book called That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. To understand how we got here, he told me, we have to go back to the early 2000s.
There was a great belief that by simply getting everybody to watch Jon Stewart every night, that we could mobilize, you know, the progressive base to enact policies that we supported. What I think happened in 2016 and what we've really seen over the last decade is that that hasn't been the case, right? Comedy is not here to save the world. And in fact, it has become a tool of the political right, the types of people that comedy was supposed to set out to undermine.
I am old enough to remember, you know, the height of The Daily Show's influence and of the Colbert Report's influence during the George W. Bush administration. For folks who are listening who maybe don't remember that or were alive for it but have sort of forgotten it because of the fog of everything that has happened since then. Remind us a little bit about the influence that these satirists had.
One of the buzzwords of the sort of Trump era has been mis and disinformation. That phenomenon really starts seriously in the early 2000s with the run-up to the Iraq War and the sort of ongoing justification of it by the W. Bush administration. So Colbert and Stewart were really the sort of leaders of the media world on the left who were willing to call BS on the lies that the administration was using. And this stood in contrast to a, you know, center and right-leaning media apparatus that was supporting, believing, buying into the story for war that the Bush administration was selling. So they were kind of a voice of reason amid all this sort of insanity that was surrounding us at the time.
Yeah, yeah. As you're saying that, I'm reminded of Colbert's invention of the word truthiness.
That's right.
Because you're looking at a straight shooter, America. I tell it like it is. I calls them like I sees them. I will speak to you in plain, simple English. And that brings us to tonight's word. Truthiness.
The idea that something, it doesn't have to be right as long as you believe it and as long as you can kind of sell it convincingly to people, right?
Yeah, I mean, and now we have the through the looking glass version where Trump routinely accuses legitimate news organizations of making things up out of whole cloth and calling that fake news.
Right. We've got competing versions of reality now, right? People just sort of choose to believe the set of facts that suit their political agenda. That very much has its roots in the sort of Iraq conflict 20 years ago and Stuart Colbert, you know, calling that out.
Yeah. And can I ask you, I mean, one of the other seminal comedic moments from the left directed at the right that I remember from the early to mid 2000s as being a moment where comedy really played a role in shaping public perception was Tina Fey's Sarah Palin impression.
You know, Hillary and I don't agree on everything.
Anything. I believe that diplomacy should be the cornerstone of any foreign policy.
And I can see Russia from my house.
I think 2008 very much solidifies politicians and comedy as a sort of media phenomenon, first and foremost. I think you really see that as the starting point for Americans' understanding of presidential politics and the people who populate that universe as things they encounter on their television screens first and as things with material outcomes and policy outcomes second.
We started our conversation with you talking about how beginning with that 2016 election is when the effectiveness of left-leaning comedy and the directionality of where comedy was aimed started to shift a little bit. How did that shift take shape?
the first thing that happens is that formula grows a little bit stale, right? The Daily Show loses Stewart. They cycle through a few hosts. We've got news comedy hybrids all over the cable television dial and all over our social media. So I think that formula starts to wear thin and people get kind of used to it and aren't sure that it is the thing to attack the right with anymore. At the same time, the media world continues to fracture and continues to create hyper-specific audience groups along political ideology, race, religion, age, ethnicity. So that's another trend that's long been in place. The opening becomes very ripe then for someone to try and succeed with conservative and right-wing comedy, coinciding with Trump's rise to power.
How much of this do you think has to do with the fact that Trump sort of campaigned in his first term like an insult comic?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, calling Jeb Bush low-energy Jeb.
Am I talking or are you talking, Jeb?
I'm talking right now. I'm talking.
You can go back. You're not talking. I know you're trying to build up your energy, Jeb, but it's not working.
One at a time.
Yeah.
Look. We need a toughness.
Donald, you're not going to be able to insult your way to the presidency. That's not going to happen. And I do have the strength.
The permission structure that Trump creates in his sort of insult comic address is one of giving license to the rest of the country to kind of do the same, right? Much of the Obama era, there was a move towards, you know, polite kind of identity politics where we're very concerned with saying the right things and identifying people in the right way. Trump throws water on that and says, I'm going to be sort of unabashedly brazen, hateful, divisive at times. And that's the power of comedy, right? It very strongly creates in-groups and out-groups. If you extend that out to many of the conservative figures who are both political activists, part of the entertainment world, this is all they do. This is their sort of entire reason for getting in front of a microphone every day. It's to say what's wrong with liberal political ideas and not offering necessarily anything substantive in place of that.
Yes, this makes me think of somebody like the Fox News commentator, Jesse Waters.
The Democrats, what they've done is they've feminized themselves in order to win elections, and then they lost the election, and then they lost their manhood. I have rules for men. They're just funny. They're not that serious. Like, you don't eat soup in public.
Uh-huh.
You don't cross your legs. And you don't drink from a straw. And one of the reasons you don't drink from a straw is because the way your lips purse. It's very effeminate.
So let me ask you, Nick, you know, one of the reasons we were interested in talking to you today is because there was an event here recently at ASU, a stand-up comedy show that was sponsored by Turning Point USA, which is, of course, a very far-right political organizing group. Rather than having a rally or a debate event like they have held there in the past, they instead had a stand-up comedy show with this stand-up comedian named Alex Stein, who is very provocative, very right-wing comic. And as we've been talking about, there's not necessarily anything new about comedy and politics swimming alongside each other. But it did seem maybe a little bit new to me, on the right at least, this idea of saying, we're going to have a comedy event, but it's also going to be a political safe space for you to come out and find like-minded people.
There's plenty of media audience research indicating that Gen Z, college students especially, do not seek out or want political information from conventional sources. If you overtly identify as political, that's kind of a turnoff. And so what you've seen many political projects do, especially on the right, is precisely what you said, brand initially as, oh, having a friendly debate, right? This is what Charlie Kirk specialized at, and Steven Crowder, people like that. Or saying, we're going to have a comedy event. And at the same time, you'll, of course, find like-minded, whatever, family-focused or faith-based people to interact with. So the less that you're overtly branding something as political, I think the more attractive it is to the next generation of voters. And that's certainly a demographic group that the right has been trying to attract as its voting base ages.
Yeah. Well, and I just have to say, I mean, from my own reporting here in the area, I remember going last year to an ASU College Republicans event, like an official meeting of the ASU College Republicans. And I think there were seven people there.
Yeah.
And from what I've seen in the reporting of this Turning Point comedy show, there were 100 people there.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah. I'm going to guess, based on the conversation, Sam, we're maybe around the same age. Are you an elder millennial like me or thereabouts?
I sure am. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's something about the millennial impulse to politicize culture or to say, before you can enjoy culture, you have to know its politics and deem whether or not it's good or bad. I think as someone who interacts with college students every day, Gen Z doesn't think like that. They don't know or care about what the politics are of the culture they're consuming is. They're just more concerned that there's a kind of steady stream of it. Like, if there's somebody I like, I want more of it, and I'm going to continue to spend time with this person.
Interesting. So in the case of comedy, funny first, politics second.
Correct. And funny to many young people is something that grabs attention. It is provocative. It cuts through the clutter of all the other things vying for their attention. And that is tailor-made for folks with right-leaning attitudes to kind of swoop in and do and say whatever to grab that attention.
I have been speaking with Nick Marks. He is a professor of film and media studies at Colorado State University. Nick, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 with Sam Dingman. I'm Mark Brody. Our next guest this morning hails from a place very different from the Sonoran Desert where we live, Hawaii. George Kahumoku Jr. is a master of Hawaiian music, known for his work on slack key guitar and ukulele. Known as Uncle George, he's won multiple Grammy Awards and traveled the world performing his music, which goes back generations. On top of all of that, he's also a farmer, artist, and author. And he's in the Valley this weekend to perform and teach at the Musical Instrument Museum's Experience Polynesia event. He came into our studios just after getting off the plane yesterday and sat down to tune his 12-string guitar to talk to our co-host, Lauren Gilger.
This has been in our family like since 1820.
This tuning in particular, this kind of tuning?
Sitting down to hear George Kahumoku Jr. play his guitar feels something like floating in the ocean for me, looking up at the sky.
So, yeah, tell me what you're doing while you're tuning there.
Oh.
It's not traditional. Like, you don't tune this A, B, C, D, E
normal
guitar.
I tune to C, F, C, F, A, C.
What? How many
and
strings?
My grandfather actually tuned his to an E-flat tuning.
Huh.
So, you know, we would tune to our voices. We don't care what the heck. But the problem is when you go play with other people, they can't play with you.
No.
Because it's only within our family. So when I started playing, you know, with other people, I had to find a tuning.
As he tuned up his guitar to play a little slack key for me, it quickly became clear that everything he does with his guitar is rooted way back in his family lore.
My great-grandfather was also one of the first to get learn the guitar from a Spanish cowboy who came over.
Right.
To Hawaii.
That history in which Mexican vaqueros came to Hawaii to tame a mass of roaming cattle is family history to Uncle George.
And you're going to laugh at this. I live on the street where the first cowboys came from in Santa Cruz.
He told me the whole story and played me a few songs.
Let me start with a little bit about, like, show us a little bit about what slack key means, right? It's about the way you were tuning it here, right?
Yeah, what happens is in 1793, this guy by the name of George Vancouver comes to Hawaii, and he drops off a bunch of cattle, and then they're going to the mountains, and in less than, you know, a couple, maybe 30, 40, 50 years, the herd goes into the millions. I'm not kidding, millions.
Wow.
So along comes another sea captain by the name of John Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Then he talks the king at the time to selling some land for 30 bucks or something. He gets like 300,000 acres of land.
Wow.
And then all the cattle is over there. So what he does is he actually goes over to California. It was Mexico at the time.
Right.
You know, this is like 1830s. So he finds out the Castro family, they're in charge of all these lands. So they go to Castro family and he asks, can you guys send us some cowboys? So they send three cowboys
Over just three?
Only three.
Wow.
Yeah, but they bring their horses and everything. My great-grandfather is one of the cowboys they first taught how to rope and work cattle.
Wow.
So that's during the day. But at night, they busted the guitars. They had something. You can even find this out in mariachi bands, you know?
Right.
You got three guys to make one sound.
Okay.
One guy plays the bass.
Yeah.
Then another guy plays the rhythm. Then another guy plays the lead.
Wow.
So it takes three guys to make that Spanish song.
Yeah.
So, you know, the 2 years go by, the contract is ended, they send back the cowboys. But what they did, and they leave a few guitars behind. My great-grandfather is one of those who got the guitar. But what they forgot to do is teach us how to tune these things.
So he had the Spanish guitar.
And so what we did is we combined three guitars into one where we play bass, rhythm, and lead. And this is... This is my grandfather Slacky. By slacking the strings. He was born.
There it is. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can hear all three of those parts in one That's amazing.
That's what we do, just by slacking the strings.
So a lot of history there. But I mean, to me, what's so interesting about that is it sounds so distinctly Hawaiian to me in a way that I didn't even really realize I knew.
Yeah. But then, you know, the thing is we're really influenced by the vaqueros who came to Hawaii, you know. And then a lot of the tunes, you know, the Hawaiians, actually, we didn't have melody lines.
Hmm.
It was all chant.
So it goes from that kind of traditional chanting, the vaqueros come teach you this guitar, and it turns into this kind of meld of both.
Yeah, so let me show you this other chant. It's called Hey. This chant goes back thousands of years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It goes like this. Haina ha mai ka puana hala o ka hala eita manu. So that's basically a chant about going surfing. You catch, you know, you're zigzagging and you're flying across the wave like a bird. You know, now take the same song. Now we're adding slacky.
Okay.
Bass rhythm. Same chant, but now set to Hawaiian slacky bass rhythm and lead. Yeah.
That's really cool. So, I mean, your great-grandfather taught you how to play this guitar, and you now travel all over the world, it sounds like, playing it for folks and teaching them about this. What do you think about your community and kind of where it stands today as you kind of spread it around the globe, right, with this music? Do you think about it as something that people could learn something from?
Well, I think the person who really helped me expand our world, this guy by the name of George Winston, he started recording us in the 90s. You know, we're playing it out at the beach, you know, for the tourists at Mauna Kea or whatever. Nobody's paying attention to our music. They're just, you know, they're swimming, they're dancing. All of a sudden, here comes this guy who records, he heard my radio on music and my brother's music on the radio. Mm-hmm. So he comes to Hawaii, then he starts recording my brother first. Then he recorded me as a soloist. He took away all the voices. He just made it all instrumental. Huh. But he sold, you know, my first, you know, I had my own recording company. We'd sell like maybe 10, 15, 30,000 a year. You know, it's very local. Mm-hmm. My first album with him sold over 40 million.
Yeah.
Because he reached a different audience. You see what I mean? All of a sudden, we're playing from Great American Hall in San Francisco all the way to Carnegie Hall.
That's wild. So, I mean, what do you think it was about the music that seemed to strike a chord?
What it was about the music is that I think the music was very healing, you know, for a lot of people. And then they connected to the music, and it was the vibration, this idea of this vibration that you have. Our music is really, when we play, it's about the land. It's about the ocean. It's about our environment. It's mm-hmm. about our family. It's about things we love, like flowers or plants, a loved one, you know. So the music became an expression of our way to connect with each other, you know what I mean? So
has this music been healing to you throughout your life?
Definitely. When I played music, I played at a hotel, and I played like 6-7 days a week for 5 to 6 hours. So all day long, I'm struggling with stuff, anxiety, working with at-risk kids, you know, farming, all of this stuff, roping cattle, all of that. But when I go play music 6-7 hours a day after doing all of that, this vibration is coming from my guitar. My voice is singing. It's just like going to church. Hmm. Imagine going to church 6-7 days a week. The guitar's right next to my body. It's vibrating. It's healing me. I didn't know that at the time. This is me, like, you know, 50 years later, looking back at how the vibrations and, you know, that we interact with each other can be healing. Yeah,
that's beautiful. George, you think you can take us out on a song today?
Okay. Here's a song that I'll call Peace and Harmony.
Okay.
George Kahumoku Jr. will be performing and teaching at the Musical Instrument Museum this weekend as part of their Experience Polynesia event.
Peace and harmony to send you into your weekend from the show. We thank you so much for listening today. As always, reminder that you can sign up for our weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you again on Monday morning.